This is number 0088, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0088. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Gina Mollicone-Long, who is the author of Think or Sink, The One Choice That Changes Everything. Gina actually questions if stress is a real thing.
Yeah, the back of the book at one point said stress doesn't actually exist, which got a lot of raised eyebrows. But I sort of give it the wheelbarrow test. You can't put it there, so what is it? Really, it's a decision to classify something as stressful. So once you realize that it's a decision to classify something as stressful, then you have to ask the question, well, who's making the decision?
Amelia Bradford is the author of I Am Not My Brother's Keeper. She was conflicted with having to turn her brother in over how he dealt with raising his 7 children.
It's very conflicting. It's conflicting still to this day that I turned my brother in, basically, but I could not let him continue to do this to the children any longer.
Colleen Kettenhoffen is the author of Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You. Is she getting in trouble with bosses everywhere by giving away their secrets?
I think actually they want employees to know, because I don't think they really realize how bothersome some of their biggest pet peeves are. And I think sometimes they don't always tell employees because they feel like if it's coming from them, they might as well be hearing it from their mother.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0088, is Marc-André Francourt, who is a sales rep at LaSalle Ford here in Montreal. And he's also the sales rep who is getting me my brand new set of wheels. Check out the Ford website. Check out the Ford vehicles. Test drive them. Have a good time with them and then make your choice. You know, Ford's doing some great things. And I thank Marc-André for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, in my opinion, I think some people in Arizona have just simply lost their mind. Showing their complete lack of sensitivity toward the horrible January mass shooting near Tucson, state legislators have just voted to declare the Colt Single Action Army Revolver as the official state firearm. Well, they have a state flower and a state song, so I guess a state gun. Anyway, the vote came over the strong objections of Republican Representative Albert Hale, who said, "Providing such official state recognition amounts to telling our children we're going to honor and celebrate an instrument of destruction." He said that the gun, by its nature, is designed to fire a projectile which is designed to kill something. And Hale, who is Navajo, said his people were all too often on the wrong end of that weapon. But fellow Republican Representative Eddie Farnsworth came to the defense of the legislation and rejected the idea that a weapon itself can be blamed for any deaths, whether justified or not. He said, "It's the person who is wielding those who caused the destruction, and they make that choice." He added, "This particular weapon played a tremendous role in defending families that were trying to do what was right." Yeah. Arizona. Come for the heat and duck. You know, I have a friend who lives in Arizona, and he says, "You don't feel the heat there because it's a dry heat." Yeah. Right. Meanwhile, when he's in a convertible, he has to drive wearing oven mitts. Anyway, still with Arizona, in another not-ready-for-prime-time crime story, in Mesa, 20-year-old Michael Trias was recently arrested after he completely botched a residential burglary. According to police, Trias entered the home through a window but landed in a clothes basket made of PVC pipe and nylon netting. He became so entangled in the netting, his frustrated flailing attempts to free himself alerted the homeowner, who promptly called police. What? You mean the owner in Arizona didn't shoot him? Well, Must be liberals. Meanwhile, here's a pro tip for you. If you're going to hit your ex-husband up for alimony on the grounds that you're disabled, best not to post pictures of yourself belly dancing online. In New York City, Brian McGurk went to court after discovering a blog that showed his 43-year-old ex-wife belly dancing at a gallery. Nothing wrong with belly dancing except for the fact that Dorothy McGurk had earlier won $850 a month in alimony from her ex, claiming she was disabled. In other internet postings, she wrote about dancing vigorously for several hours a day. She tried to get the court to believe that the dancing was physical therapy for injuries from a car accident in the mid-90s, but the county judge didn't buy it and reduced her payments to $400 per month. The judge also ordered her to pay her ex-husband's legal fees and 60% from the sale of their home. Smart move there, Dorothy. Maybe you should have worn a veil. And time was when only your conscience would keep you from pilfering a set of linens or a couple of towels from the hotel where you were staying. Now we have technology to keep us honest. A new washable RFID chip is being used by hotels that can be sewn into sheets, bathrobes, and towels, which means they can track where the items are and basically track you down. So far, just three hotels in Manhattan, Miami, and Honolulu are using the technology from Linen Technology Tracking. Our understanding is it's still okay to take the mini shampoo bottles and baby soaps. You know, I often found it interesting that people would steal the Bible from hotel rooms. Now that's someone with a lack of conscience. Anyway, Lucas Kokab, age 31, was arrested in Medina, Ohio in February and charged with persistent disorderly conduct after an incident that he attributed to having snorted bath salts. Yeah, you heard me right. I said bath salts. Kokab had called police to help him evict the 30 intruders in his home, and although none were found, Kokab insisted that the intruders were merely making it seem like they were not there and that they were actually blending into the surroundings disguised as chairs or trees. Police said they were forced to taser Kokab because he could not stop running in circles and yelling. The police examined the bath salts and determined that the substance is not illegal in Ohio. I mean, they're just bath salts. You know, some people will snort anything. Why don't they just give this guy a tub of potpourri and see what he does with it? Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Just how do you break the stress cycle? That's the question we have for Gina Mollicone Long. Now, she's the author of Think or Sink, the one choice that changes everything. Hi, Gina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks for having me.
The idea is that stress is not something you can actually touch or feel. It's not a real thing. So how do you deal with it?
That's great. Yeah, the back of the book at one point said stress doesn't actually exist, which got a lot of raised eyebrows. But I sort of give it the wheelbarrow test. You can't put it there, so what is it? And really, it's a decision to classify something as stressful. So once you realize that it's a decision to classify something as stressful, then you have to ask the question, well, who's making the decision? And I know that that might sound like a lot of responsibility, but it's good news because if it's you making the decision and you're having trouble with stress, then you can learn ways to make a different decision. And so then you can bring your own stress levels down by simply having a look at your life and what you classify as stressful.
It's interesting you say that because I'll give an analogy. I love to drive.
Yeah.
I'm also a terrible passenger. If you get me into traffic, I'm very, very annoyed. If I get myself into traffic, I'm not.
Right.
Is that similar to what you're saying? I know I got myself into the situation, so it's up to me to get myself out. I deal with it.
Yeah, and you know, if we could just intellectualize it, I think everybody would have fairly happy lives because we'd just think the right thing and then everything would change. But it doesn't always go that way. Who knows why you do it? But if you find yourself in situations where you're feeling a stress response, and it might not be the best use of your stress response, because when I teach, I like to teach people to understand that your stress response is a good thing. Your fight or flight response is a good thing, but it's not meant to be used all the time. So you kind of need to look at it as a commodity that you need to budget. So if you're, you know, if sitting in the passenger seat isn't something you want to spend that stress response on, then there are tips and techniques that you can use that are fairly easy to do that can just halt the stress response. You don't have to understand why. You can just halt it.
Now, I understand one of the things you advocate is look up and smile.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want the tip? Now, that's hard to do when you're actually driving. But assuming you're the passenger, because that's, you know, let's use your example. Looking up and smile. I just taught Greatness U last night. It's a program that I'm the creator of. And the people in the room, they love this technique because it takes like 13 seconds, right? Look up. If you do it right now, and if people are listening and not driving, if they look up and then smile at the same time, what happens is you've got two things going on, and you can't experience your stress response. You can't think negative thoughts in this little scenario. When you look up, you pull yourself up out of your kinesthetics, up out of your feelings, your negative emotions, because in accessing your emotions, typically neurologically, you access them by looking down. Think about when you have a bad day or when you're really mad at someone, you're often looking down. So looking up just pulls you and yanks you up out of your kinesthetics. And then smiling, as you know and everybody else knows, is linked to feeling good. It's linked to all the great biochemicals and all the triggers and being happy. And it's literally wired that way. So when you look up and smile, you can just push pause on that stress response. And it might give you the 3 seconds you need to compose yourself and make a different decision.
Now, these tips are great tips, and they would work for just about anybody who is dealing or is concerned about dealing with stress. But aren't there people out there, just like there are some people out there who seem to, for one reason or another, decide to be miserable? Aren't there some
Yep.
people also who seem to, for lack of a better term, get off on stress?
Absolutely. Oh, for sure. I mean, you're getting me on a great day because I literally just taught this not that long ago yesterday. And absolutely, we all do it. I mean, we all get something out of perpetuating some of our pain, some of our stress. You know, maybe when that person you're talking to gets stressed out, they get the attention that they really need. So the behavior is meeting a need. It's just not the best way to meet the need. And when you point that out to people, when I point that out to the people that I teach, you know, and they sit back and they go, huh, good point. It's not that it's a bad thing, although the stress response does take its toll on your body, which isn't great. It's that it's not the best way to meet the need, or it's not the healthiest way to meet the need that it's probably meeting, right? I mean, yes, if you're walking down the street and the saber-toothed tiger attacks, you better have a stress response. But pretty much most people are living in their chronic stress response for situations that don't really warrant using that precious resource.
Do we create our stress situations ourselves? In other words, could some of this be alleviated by just simple better time management?
Sure, I suppose it depends on who you are. I mean, really, what I love to do and what I'm really known for is I don't get into the content of people's problems. I love to teach them the process. So that whatever is going on in their life, if they know the process, and so if they understand that stress is a decision and it's part of a process, then they can decide if this is worth it to them, knowing the whole process. They can. So, you know what? Yes, maybe better time management, but really what it comes down to is if you can just get responsible for you have a lot more power than you think you have, and being able to make choices. Do you want to have a stress response? That's fine. Have a stress response. I'm not the stress police. But don't be a fool to think that it's not costing something somewhere. Now, maybe it's worth it to you, but if we show you all the costs and we show you the whole process, then maybe that gives you the awareness, the conscious awareness to say, this isn't worth it. You know, we have cliches like all over the map for this. Your grandmother used to tell you, you know, take a deep breath, count to 10. These are all really wise behaviors, and they all do the same thing, which is give you a minute to consider the cost of what is happening.
It seems to be that in our rat race, fast-paced world, one of the things we seem to have forgotten about, like you mentioned with grandmothers, is simple common sense, and that your book is basically giving people back the tools to use some of their own common sense.
I love common sense because it's common, right? I don't tell people what to do. Like I said, I'm not the stress police. I'm not the behavior police, time management police. But I really believe if you teach people the process and you just bring the whole thing into awareness, people are pretty smart. And they know what they need to do for themselves, but a lot of the times people are just forgot that it was a process. They're on autopilot. And you know what? We're busy. We're busy people. You know, we all have stress responses. The question is it worth it to you to have the stress response?
And don't
pretend it's not nothing. Don't just run around going, oh, it's stress. It's not me. It's stress. No, no. Stress is a decision. It's not happening outside of you.
And also, take action. Don't just wallow in your problems.
Oh, absolutely, right? If it's a problem, then figure out a way to get around it, under it, over it, through it. But focusing on it's just going to bring you more problem.
You go around and you teach, as you mentioned. What is the reaction when you teach initially? Do you find people are sometimes skeptical? Do you have to win them over?
Well, I think people are, yeah, I wouldn't say win them over. I think they just, for so long, we've been fed a lot of beliefs that we don't have a lot of power, that somebody needs to tell us what to do, that people need to decide our fate, that we don't have a lot of control, that, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, we've got an election coming up, right? There's nothing I can do about it. Well, of course there is. So when I sit down, at first they're listening with, you know, sort of one ear, and then all of a sudden when they realize, I'm not trying to tell them what to do. I'm just here to show you how it works. And you need to do whatever you need to do, then 100%, when people get there and they realize how much control and power they have in creating their own destiny, then they get on board pretty quickly with really being truthful about how many choices they make in the day that are good for them and how many choices they make in the day that really don't serve them.
Besides the book, Think or Sink, the one choice that changes everything, you also have a website. What will people find when they go to the website?
Well, I've got a website, but, you know, really I'm so excited about Greatness U right now because it's a four-part program that is like the book but putting it into action. We're doing this like crazy. So greatnessu.com is where we're telling everybody, listen, we're trying to teach you in four completely standalone courses. So it's not like you have to keep coming back. You can keep coming back. But I'm really committed to getting people whatever it is they want in their life and showing them how it's not that hard to get.
The book is called Think or Sink, The One Choice That Changes Everything. It's written by Gina Mollicone-Long. And again, the website is Greatness U. That's the letter U. GreatnessU.com. Gina, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gina Mollicone-Long, author of Think or Sink, The One Choice That Changes Everything. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0088, and you'll find links to Gina's website, plus links to Amazon.com for the Kindle, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of I'm Not My Brother's Keeper. Plus, we'll teach you some of the secrets your boss isn't telling you. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for you. And as a matter of fact, right now, something we don't do very often, as a matter of fact, we've only done it once before, but we do it on occasion when it warrants it, and that would be the Charlie Sheen Award.
I'm by winning.
An opportunity for someone to do something incredibly stupid while under the influence of something or other.
I am on a drug. It's called Charlie Sheen.
In Fort Walton Beach, Florida, a 32-year-old man was reportedly drunk and disrupting other customers at the Swamp nightclub. He was asked to leave the property, but refused unless his bullwhip and cap to a dry erase marker were returned to him.
You know, I got tiger blood, man.
Okay, doesn't he know, first of all, bullwhips, the people who usually have bullwhips, like the guy in Indiana Jones, get shot. Second, how important is the cap to a dry erase marker? Anyway, the whip was found, but sheriff's deputies told the man they could do nothing about the cap. He then allegedly told the deputy he was a sniper in the Marines and would be back to kill him. That, of course, got him arrested, and while he was in the back of the deputy's car, he began to kick in the right rear passenger window. The deputy opened the door and shackled the man's legs, who then allegedly tried to kick the deputy in the face. Since our friend failed to calm down and stop kicking the windows, the deputy called for a booking van. As the deputy walked the man to the van, the guy slammed his body into the right rear side of the van and then slammed his head against it several times before deputies got him inside the van. The damages caused to the van were an estimated $500. The damages caused to the guy's head were estimated at, oh, who cares? In any case, congrats, pal.
You borrow my brain for 5 seconds and just be like, dude, can't handle it. Unplug this bastard, yeah.
You are the latest winner of the Charlie Sheen Award.
Wow, winning.
Wear it with pride. Wear it with pride. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, former insurance agent Samuel McAllister Jr. stole nearly $450,000 from 23 investors over several years, but managed to stay out of prison after convincing prosecutors it would be better to let him participate in a poker tournament so that he could win his victims' money back. But after nothing but bad luck at the poker table, he was finally sentenced to 12 years in prison, 5 years of supervised probation after his release, and ordered to make full restitution to his victims. J.D. Dennis Jr., the superintendent of the New Mexico Regulation and Licensing Department, said, "This was long overdue. This individual wanted to con us into believing that keeping him out of prison would help his victims get their money back. We're calling his bluff. It's about time we sent him to prison." Gee, what are the odds of that happening, huh? Yeah. And under a fresh new censorship crackdown in China, the government wants to ban all TV shows that feature time travel. No, I'm not making this up, really. Regulators have imposed tough new conditions on television production, arguing such plots are frivolous in respect to history. And we know how the Chinese spend a lot of time taking care and properly delving out their history, don't we? The State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television guidance thus would ban films like Back to the Future and television series like Life on Mars. It criticized time travel dramas which casually make up myths, have monstrous and weird plots, use absurd tactics, and even promote feudalism, superstition, fatalism, and reincarnation. Such shows are said to be insulting because they are treating serious history in a frivolous way, which should by no means be encouraged anymore. Yes, communism, getting sillier every day. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest, at Lakeside Shopping Center in Essex, England, a promotion promised ladies the chance to arrive in their underwear and leave fully clothed in a fabulous new look for the new season. The first 100 girls who turned up wearing only their underwear and a pair of high heels won a $150 gift card. All entrants had to be over the age of 18 and had to agree to have their photo taken as part of the Lakeside's Flash of Fashion promotion. And yes, it was quite successful, as many young ladies showed up in bras, panties, and high heels. Absolutely nothing sexist or demeaning about this whatsoever, right? Of course not. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? In an ideal world, our brothers and sisters will be closer to us than anyone else, but the world is not an ideal place, and sometimes our siblings are tragically flawed human beings. On the line with us right now is Amelia Bradford, and by the way, that is not her real name. She is the author of the book I Am Not My Brother's Keeper, and she's here to share her story. Hi, Amelia.
Hello.
So you tell this harrowing story of having to deal with your brother. First of all, is this an older or younger sibling?
He is 8 years younger than me.
So what exactly was the problem with your brother that it reached to this point where you've written this book?
Well, excuse me. I was reluctant to use the word abuse because obviously no one wants to think that about their brother or their sister or, you know, anyone in the family. But I watched over the years, they continued to have 7 children and would just treat them badly, not feed them properly. Like, they would just feed them something for breakfast and then they wouldn't have anything till dinner time. They weren't allowed to go out to play. They had to stay in playpens until they were like 4 years old. And my brother was extremely controlling with them. He would tell them to just stop crying, and they would stop. How that worked, I never knew. So over the years, I just really couldn't take it anymore. And it was many years before I had my children. And when I tried to speak up and say something, he would say, well, what do you know? You don't even have any children. Well, I said, well, I have common sense. And I have a master's degree in psychology, and what you're doing is inappropriate completely. And they were all starting to walk bow-legged from being in the playpen for too long. Of course, that would happen. And then, so then I just was talking to his wife's mother one day, and she called somebody to report them.
Okay, so your problem with your brother was not a situation that happened while you were growing up with your brother. It's the way he's raising his own children.
Absolutely. My mother was nothing like that. In fact, we just don't know why he is the way he is. The controlling, he even says in my book that he has, if you talk with him and speak with him about it, he'll tell you that he has a godlike complex. You know, that he's, like, basically he thinks he's, like, God.
So as the saying goes, blood is thicker than water. It must have been a difficult situation for you to come forward when you saw what your brother was doing, because he is your brother.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you say that blood is thicker than water. My husband and I were just talking about that, and I said, not always the case, and this is a perfect example of what I did, and it was. I mean, I don't know if you read the book, but it goes on and on, the help that we just gave him. It went on, and everyone who's read it said, oh, I can't believe why you just kept doing it. And I said, because he is my brother, and I would hope that my children would do the same for each other. I have a son and a daughter, but there's a time to stop anything and everything when it gets to that point, that's what happened.
You mentioned you were discussing this with your husband. I understand that over the years you and your husband lent your brother money.
To the tune of about $70,000.
Did this cause any rift between you and your husband?
No. He was very supportive. He said, well, if we needed help and someone, you know, we would do it for us maybe. And I said, well, not in my family. But he, toward the end, was kind,
sort of getting a little bit, you know, well, this is ridiculous. But we were both there anyway, and by that time the court system was already involved. But no, it didn't. He said, you make the decision. You know, a lot of times we didn't give money, and we would set up accounts, like, at stores for them to do grocery shopping, which he didn't like because he wanted to have the money. But, you know, or another time he needed a lawyer, and we said we would take care of it, that we would not pass money into his hands any longer.
So what is the relationship with you and your brother now?
Nothing. One of his sons who wasn't put it, so seven children, so now three are old enough to have gone back to them, which is very amazing, but one of the daughters is 22, so she's sort of got her own place, and the other two are 19 and 18, and then the other three were totally adopted out, so we can't see them, and that's a shame for my children because they're around the same ages. But then one, my nephew, has serious disassociation. I forgot what it's called. It's like a disorder when you don't feel connected to anybody. And he's been in, we lost count, maybe 40 different foster homes and psychiatric care facilities. And so he will not be adopted out.
Do you have any relationship with any of your nieces and nephews?
No, we're not allowed. The adoptive parents don't feel the situation, even though I've proven, and the social services people that I had become very friendly with, they've assured them that I have nothing to do with my brother, but they're still very threatened by the fact that, you know, I am his blood sister, and, you know, they just don't trust the situation, which we think is extremely unfair because it's not fair to the children, my nieces, nor my children, who, you know, they've known them their whole lives as their cousins. So
it must be very difficult to know you have done the right thing. You went to the authorities in dealing with your brother, but that in a certain way you are being punished because you don't get to see your flesh and blood, your nieces and nephews.
That's right.
It must be conflicting for you that way.
It's very conflicting. It's conflicting still to this day that I turned my brother in, basically, but I could not let him continue to do this to the children any longer. But he was so adamant that he was right, that, you know, they said produce school papers for us because he homeschooled his children. He had nothing to produce, that, you know, no work to produce that the children did. I homeschooled my daughter till she was in ninth grade, and I did it officially. And if anyone asked me for any documentation, I had everything. And so he kept them very socially isolated. And Debbie, his wife, her name is Susan in the book. She did nothing. She did absolutely nothing, and my brother just sort of...
What is the relationship? What is the relationship between your brother and his wife? Because while this is all going on, was she complacent in all of this? Did she go
absolutely
along with all this?
No, she was complacent, and she would defend my brother to the hilt. In fact, she did, which winded her up in jail. And she took his side over the children's, which, I mean, as a mother, I'm like, okay, I love my husband, but you don't, you know, not your children. Mm. And so both of them they chose to disobey the judge. The judge said these children all need medicals. I have one niece who has a heart murmur, and they ignored it. And it got worse. And she's the one, she was the baby, but we really wanted to keep a relationship going with them. But so that's the sad part. And when this book comes out and when it gets in his hands, he's going to not be real happy about it, but that's the least of my concerns.
I'm
glad I got
What made you write the book, and who are you writing the book for? Do you think there are other people living your kind of life, your situation, who could be helped by this book?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think there are, actually. I really do. And number one reason that I did it was I'm a writer at heart, and I always have been. Like, just, you know, I've kept a journal since I was like 14. And so I just had this writer thing in my blood, and it just, the words just kept flowing one day, and because I had all the notes and all the wired receipts that we sent money and receipts that we gave money, and you know, it's a lot for a family like my husband and myself and a brand new baby and then another brand new baby, you know, eventually that we had to just do all this. I mean, we had, and I would tell him over and over, you know, we have our own family. We can't keep taking care of you and yours. And so I'm sorry, your exact question was, and I think I got off track.
The idea of who you wrote this book for.
Oh, for, there are a couple of different reasons. For any other people out there who may or may not, I know it sounds like really, like it's the same answer that people give when they write a book, but, you know, they might know someone and not know what to do, and then maybe if they see that, wow, his own sister turned him in, you know, okay, I can have the nerve to turn my neighbor in or something.
Well, the thing that I know it's not a current comfort, but the fact of the matter is time goes by very quickly, and your nieces and nephews will be adults, and I'm sure at some point they'll realize just what you've done for them, and perhaps you'll have a relationship with them a little later on. I thank you very, very much, Amelia, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you.
Amelia Bradford, author of I'm Not My Brother's Keeper. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0088, and you'll find links to Amazon.com where you can order her book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's a threat none of us ever want to hear, your money or your life. Most of us associate that threat with an armed robber. But for innocent people who've been sued, that's often how they feel, too. Judges who don't throw out frivolous lawsuits can force a person who's done nothing wrong to spend their life savings defending their good name. In these cases, the only winners are the lawyers. In the worst cases involving class action lawsuits, lawyers can rake in millions of dollars for themselves, even when the case has no merit. Let's be fair, there are legitimate class action lawsuits, but when class members receive worthless coupons and their lawyers walk away with millions, that's not fair either. So when I heard that a group fighting abusive class action lawsuits was able to reroute millions of dollars to class members that would have gone to the plaintiff lawyers and their pet causes, I thought you should know. The group is the Center for Class Action Fairness, and it just might be able to help you someday too. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll tell you about secrets your boss isn't telling you, and we, of course, have an idiot of the day. But before we get to all of that, one more Stuff File story in the news that I want to share with you before we get to our next guest. Brock Hopkins was severely injured 3 years ago when he was mauled by a captive grizzly bear at Great Bear Adventures near West Glacier, Montana. Hopkins admits he smoked marijuana before entering the bear enclosure and attempted to feed them, despite instructions to stay away. Those actions, however, were not the issue. Despite being characterized as mind-bogglingly stupid by the Montana Workers' Compensation Court, Hopkins filed for comp payments for his injuries, and the privately owned park was fighting against paying, saying Hopkins was a volunteer. The case went all the way to the state Supreme Court, which noted that because the park's owner sometimes gave Hopkins money, he was an employee and therefore entitled to compensation. Wow. Next case up, the Bears. It's upset over his allegedly spiked food. You know, it's interesting how Brock smokes a joint, but it's the bear that gets the munchies. That's the kind of thing that Bob DiRigo Jones would find interesting for his Let's Be Fair segment. Maybe I'll pass that one along to him. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the program, shall we? What if you could know what your boss is thinking, their employee likes and dislikes, who they want to hire and fire? On the line with us right now is workplace expert Colleen Kettenhofen. She is the author of Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
I'm doing just fine. Right off the bat, I have to ask, are bosses getting upset that you're giving away their secrets?
You know, that's a good question. And I think actually they want employees to know, because I don't think they really realize how bothersome some of their biggest pet peeves are. And I think sometimes they don't always tell employees because they feel like if it's coming from them, they might as well be hearing it from their mother. And so I think sometimes they like having me come in. I'm actually hired to go into organizations or speak before associations at conferences, training managers and others in how to manage employees and how to deal with difficult people.
So what are some of the biggest pet peeves that bosses have when it comes to employees?
Well, I'll start with the one that's very obvious, and then I'll go into the ones that people may not realize are at the top of the list. The first one, Peter, what you would expect, excessive absenteeism and chronic tardiness. Also, the clock watchers who arrive late and take off so fast from work that they leave skid marks, and they've got the excuses such as, I've got to get home to the kids or the husband, or my wife's not working, or they're late due to construction, inclement weather. So when there's a litany of excuses, managers tune out and tune in to the idea of taking disciplinary action.
Now, I'm just curious, because you mentioned some of the excuses, and one of the ones you tossed in there was, I've got to get home to the kids. And I'm wondering if that excuse is, well, first of all, A, really an excuse, and B, if it's a different response if your boss is a male as opposed to a female.
I think what it boils down to is when the employee interviewed for the job, if they know that there are specific hours that they're going to have to work, and especially if they know that the company may not be able to be flexible, then I think the bosses, at least from what they told me, because I interviewed over 200 bosses just based on all the speaking engagements that I've conducted in 48 states and 5 foreign countries for more than 15 years. So really what bosses said to me is, if they knew when they were interviewing and right before we hired them that these were going to be the hours they would have to work, then we would expect them to be able to work around those hours. Having said that, there are a lot of companies nowadays that do want to be flexible to employees, both male and female, if they have children. So this is really more the people where they take advantage of it and they're purposely calling in sick, or as I hear now a lot with typically people between 16 and 24, sometimes texting in sick, or the people who are chronically tardy. So it's really more when the bosses sense that there are, the phrase they kept using with me, excuses in general. And some of them actually said to me, my feeling, Colleen, is if they're not here, why am I paying them? So it's really more the people who are chronic and really taking advantage over somebody where maybe legitimately they're really trying to make it work. But if you want to hear second and third on the list, these could almost be number one.
And they are?
Okay, the second biggest pet peeve of over 200 bosses that I surveyed, the whole number two was negativity, subversiveness, and lack of buy-in. In other words, this is the problem child whiner who complains, has no solutions, or says, I don't get paid enough to worry about that. Or they say sarcastically, it's not my job. So managers don't want to manage a whiner or water cooler instigator, as I call them, someone who rallies everyone around their complaints, and they're complaining about how busy they are, but I refer to them as busy doing nothing because they're usually doing more complaining.
Okay, the other side of that coin, what if somebody has a legitimate right or reason to complain? Are you saying that employees should never complain?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, a lot of times when I am doing training for managers and supervisors, they'll say to me, you know, Colleen, I know a big pet peeve with bosses is negativity with no solutions. So they said, I'm very judicious in going in and complaining to the boss. In other words, pick your battles. You know, if you really feel like it is a legitimate complaint, go in and talk with your boss about it in a very low, controlled tone of voice. And I think the key is that managers and supervisors told me they want somebody to come in with what they think is the solution or just to offer a solution and ask what the boss thinks of their idea. So we're really talking here more about the chronic complainer, because these people can create a lot of drama. And actually, what ranked third overall with the boss's biggest frustrations was high drama. And these people can leave the same bitter aftertaste, the disruptive gossips, the squealers or the tattletales, you know, going to the boss about an issue that really is not even an issue. They're just wanting to squeal on another employee. Sense of entitlement employees, and also what I call the pot stirrers, just people that like to gossip and complain. Social butterflies, I heard a lot about from bosses, the individuals who socialize, especially in that first hour of the workday. They come in, but they're not really working, they're socializing. And then a real big one for bosses, and certainly employees, is the people who talk about their personal lives all day, every day.
Now, I understand there are some employees that are the hardest to both hire and fire. Who are these employees?
Well, it's interesting because people who are harder to fire, unfortunately, what I found in my in-depth conversations with managers was they can be hard to hire. And I was surprised at how much managers confided in me. And I don't mean confided in terms of telling me privately, but I'm talking about in speaking engagements that I conducted, open speaking engagements, for example, at conferences where I would just ask people, you know, what makes you fire one person or what makes you hire one person. And I actually had a few bosses who said, Colleen, if I know that someone's going to be harder to hire, or excuse me, harder to fire, if I know someone's going to be harder to fire, I am less likely to hire that person. And I actually had a manager say to me in front of a whole room of people, he said, for example, if I know a woman is of childbearing age, I'm less likely to hire her because she knows that if she gets pregnant, she can do anything she wants, and I can't fire her. And I was absolutely dumbfounded.
Isn't that almost against the law?
You know, I would agree with you. I really think that it is, and I was surprised that this person would say this in front of so many people. Now, I do want to emphasize, you know, it's only a few managers who say these things. A lot of the radio interviews that I've had have been conducted by men, and they are as flabbergasted as the women. And I actually interviewed a business owner on an airplane when I was flying home from one of my training sessions, and I remember that business owner, I would say he was in his early 60s, he said to me and the woman next to me, whom he didn't know her either, he said, well, if I can help it, I am less likely to hire a woman because if she's married, she's the breadwinner. So with her husband earning more money, she doesn't really have the same pressures as a man. If I had been a rocket, Peter, I would have shot to Saturn in a nanosecond.
Well, let me ask you one last quick question because we're just about running out of time. Mm-hmm. Based on what you said, your book, Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You, who best learns from reading your book, an employer or an employee?
I would say the employee would best learn from this book because it really helps you in how to keep your job in any economy. There's a whole chapter in there on the top 10 biggest frustrations of bosses. There's other ones like being combative, challenging authority, texting, excessive use spent on the internet, and so forth. But there's also a chapter in there on how to get a great job, what employers look for on interviews. So it's really for employees as well as people looking for a job. And if you think about it, even bosses themselves are employees because they have a manager as well.
Good point. The book is called Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You. And it's you can check out her website at bouncebackhire.com. Colleen, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, thank you, Peter. And lastly, I just want to say we also have CDs on the website, Bounce Back Hire, as well as the book.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Colleen.
Thank you.
Colleen Kettenhoffen, author of Secrets Your Boss Isn't Telling You. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0088, and you'll find links to Colleen's website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up, we have an idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
You know those cute little junior police officer stickers police officers hand out to kids? Well, try to remember they don't really entitle you to any actual police powers. In Joliet, Illinois, police arrested 35-year-old Hector S. Garcia Martinez after he allegedly flashed his lights and pulled over beside two women sitting in a parked car. He allegedly told them that he was a cop, but they were suspicious and asked to see some credentials. That's when Garcia Martinez reportedly pointed to the Woodbridge Police Junior Officer sticker that was on his front license plate. The women then called 911, and our junior police officer was dumb enough to sit around and wait for them to arrive. He first told the real officers he was also a police officer, but then admitted he was not. Police then looked into his car and found an open can of beer, a loaded handgun, and a baggie containing a small amount of marijuana. Now our friend will have plenty of time to see how real police officers work. Why would someone fake being a police officer with a child sticker, all the while carrying cocaine? One reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0088. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. At the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0088. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. Don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been
been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.